Until we can face poverty and low wages in this country, we're talking about 66 million white people. We're talking about 26 million black people, 60% of black people, 30% of white people, 68% of Latinos, 68% of indigenous people. We cannot walk away from this issue. And lastly, we cannot allow people to suggest that if you focus on this issue, that it's a far left issue. It's an American issue. It's a moral issue. It is the level of poverty, low wages in this country is a violation of our claim of our Constitution to establish justice and promote the general welfare. It is disgusting and damnable that we've not had a full-on dealing with this issue in the media, in the halls of Congress, and in our election. Not one presidential candidate was asked at any of the two debates that were held, where do you stand on the issue of poverty and low wages, and what are your plans to address it, and how will you lead this country that for issues that affect nearly 50% of the population? We got to face this issue. And that's why one of the things I'm saying, Amy, you know, Venus Williams said something in a poem that we all of us ought to read. It said, she said this, "You are awakening to the same country you fell asleep to, the very same country. Pull yourself together. And when you see me, do not ask me, what do we do now or how do we get through the next 4 years? Some of my ancestors dealt with at least 400 years under worse conditions." She said, continue to do the good work. Continue to build bridges and not walls. Continue to lead with compassion. Continue to demand the liberation of all. I would add to that, continue and seriously fight for living wages and health care and the end to genocide around the world and the end to the battle of war in Gaza. Continue the fight for women's rights. Continue to fight for children. Continue to fight to expand voting rights. How much of this low vote was because of voter suppression? Why is it in a state like North Carolina, for instance, all of the Democrats at the top of the ticket won? And yet the presidency did not win. We have to deal with some serious questions. We can't get in our emotions. We've got to ask serious questions because we have serious pain out here that people are hurting, and millions of them didn't vote either way. They just didn't vote. I want people to hear that. The vote totals went down. They didn't go up. They went down, and we have to take this very seriously.
Bishop William Barber, I want to thank you for being with us. National co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, co-author of the new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Next up, we go to former Bernie Sanders advisor David Sirota. He's head of The Lever, and he wrote the article, Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroyed Democracy, back in 30 seconds.
And I guess you may not see it too. I know that you are tired. It's never ending.
Jasmine Jiang singing Meet Me in Space at a New York Immigration Coalition rally Thursday night. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at where the Democrats went wrong, we're joined now by David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, host of its new investigative podcast, Master Plan. His new piece, headlined Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroyed Democracy. Those billionaires, David Sirota writes, included Elon Musk, who spent about $120 million to help Trump get elected and saw his net worth soar by over $16 billion after Trump secured victory. Other billionaires campaigned for Kamala Harris, such as Mark Cuban, who was her top TV surrogate, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who spoke at the Democratic National Convention in August. This is a clip.
Donald Trump thinks that we should trust him on the economy. because he claims to be very rich. But take it from an actual billionaire. Trump is rich in only one thing, stupidity.
For more on how the Democrats lost the election and what is next, David Sirota joins us from snowy Denver, Colorado. His August piece for The Guardian is headlined Project 2025, started a half century ago. A Trump win could solidify it forever. And David Sirota was also senior communications advisor and speechwriter for Bernie Sanders when he ran for president. Welcome back to Democracy Now, David. Talk about the billionaires.
Well, look, I think what was different about this election, and to be clear, there's been billionaires funding elections from the shadows, certainly an upsurge of that since the Citizens United decision. But I think what was different about this election was how central billionaires were in the entire political discourse. I mean, billionaires were on the national stage. Elon Musk, Mark Cuban, you had billionaires like Reid Hoffman, Barry Diller, demanding, if Kamala Harris won, demanding the firing of FTC Chair Lina Khan. So billionaires were really in our face this time in a way that they really haven't been before. And billionaires, I should mention, were celebrated. That clip that you just played of billionaire Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Democratic Convention celebrating billionaires as a credential. And that speech came, by the way, right after Bernie Sanders spoke at the Democratic Convention, saying we got to essentially reduce the power of billionaires in politics. So we've come a long way, and in my view, not in a great direction towards our elections being celebrations of billionaires, our elections being battlegrounds for billionaires to have their fights, to center their issues. And essentially, what ends up happening is that the 2024 election that was supposed to be about saving democracy was essentially an exercise in destroying what was left of democracy, turning our elections themselves into an open celebration of the oligarchy. And I think if we simply walk away from this election and say, hey, the Democrats lost because they didn't have enough billionaires and the Republicans won because they more billionaire money went to Donald Trump, and we define our democracy as just a battle of billionaires, then the question is, in the battle to save democracy, what are we actually saving and for whom?
So during the presidential campaign, as you just said, two major Democratic donors, media mogul Barry Diller, LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, publicly called for Kamala Harris to fire the head of the Federal Trade Commission, Lina Khan, who's led Biden's antitrust efforts. Hoffman sits on the board of Microsoft, which was sued by the FTC. He was interviewed on CNN by Jake Tapper.
Thanks for joining us. So you and other big money donors are giving money to Vice President Harris, suggesting also that she replace the head of the FTC, which impacts policy and the economy. What do you say to somebody who watches this and says, this isn't how American politics should work, rich people getting to buy levels of influence?
Well, I totally agree with not buying levels of influence. I separate my role as a donor and expert. So if you ask me as a donor, I say I'm giving money to Kamala Harris because I think she's the best future president for the U.S., for business, for a bunch of other things. If you ask me as an expert about what, you know, kind of Lina Khan is doing and whether I think she is helping or hurting America relative to your anti-merger policies, which are, you know, mostly to bring litigation versus, you know, really solidly grounded in kind of what's going on, what helps American business thrive here and overseas, then I give an expert opinion. But I think donor and expert should be kept separate. And I've never tied the two ever in any conversation anywhere I've ever had.
So that's billionaire Reid Hoffman, supporter of Kamala Harris. David Sirota, since economy was a top issue, inflation a top issue, if you can talk about what it meant to be against Lina Khan and what she represented, but most importantly, the power of these billionaires, and not just, of course, on the Democratic side, because the Republican who won, President Trump, he had Elon Musk giving out $1 million a day to voters.
Look, I think the Lena Khan example is really important, because while Reid Hoffman insists that his money has nothing to do with his policy demands, functionally, that's not the way things work. I mean, Joe Biden back in the 1970s talked about this when he first got elected, about how money always comes with a demand. Money always comes in politics with strings attached. Functionally, the way this works, these people are not giving money simply out of the goodness of their own of their hearts. They want things. They have policy demands. And I think, as you mentioned, Elon Musk, that's another great example. I mean, Elon Musk running around spending big money to help elect Donald Trump while saying he's going to accept a job in the Trump administration. Donald Trump saying he's going to appoint him to a job that would oversee the reshaping of federal spending and the federal budget at a time when Elon Musk runs companies that are major federal contractors. So in a sense, Elon Musk could be in a job where he could shape the government to enrich the companies that Elon Musk owns. This is what money in politics really is. It is an investment. And the investors, the donors, like billionaires, are looking for a return on their investment. That's what this is, a business strategy.
So let's talk about what Musk is going to get in return. You report that the Senate Republicans' scheme to let Trump self-police ethics, Republicans have been blocking the appointment of the government's ethics enforcement official till after the election so that Trump can now appoint, as you put it, his own crony who can waive all ethics laws for his new White House and then address the issue of Project 2025.
So the Office of Government Ethics is the independent office that is supposed to enforce anti-corruption rules when it comes to the executive branch. When executive branch officials come into office, the Office of Government Ethics reviews whether they have conflicts of interest in their own holdings, and then will say you have to divest from this or that if your job is overseeing things that pose a conflict of interest for you. The Republicans, that job has been held open, blocked in the Senate by the Republicans for more than a year, kept that job open. And Senator Mike Lee of Utah has said he wants to keep it open. He said this in a floor speech in the Senate, saying they want to keep it open until after the election so that if Donald Trump wins, Donald Trump can appoint his own head of the Office of Government Ethics to a five-year term, which in practice would allow Trump to hire somebody who he would already know was going to enforce or not enforce this or that ethics laws for incoming executive branch officials. So would somebody like Elon Musk get a waiver from anti-corruption laws? Would any other billionaire serving in Donald Trump's cabinet get those kinds of waivers to allow them to essentially serve in dual roles, owning companies, but also running federal agencies that regulate those companies? And as it relates to Project 2025, one of the central tenets of Project 2025 is the initiative to help Trump appoint more political loyalists, in other words, decimating the civil service, the supposedly and supposed to be nonpartisan civil service. Again, when you think about packing the executive branch with Trump loyalists who may have financial conflicts of interest, and then consider that Trump will be able to effectively appoint his own political loyalist to oversee the enforcement or non-enforcement of anti-corruption and ethics laws, it puts together a situation where people may be coming into the government who are able to use the government to enrich themselves.
Can you talk about what Musk and Trump have been promoting, leading a new Department of Government Efficiency, the initials DOGE or DOGE, also referring to that meme coin cryptocurrency that Musk has been promoting?
Yeah, I mean, the best we can tell from what has been described is that Elon Musk is going to head up some kind of commission, potentially with a lot of cross-agency power, to propose and enact radical reshaping of the federal government, and potentially a radical privatization of government services, government activities. And again, I go back to the fact that Elon Musk runs companies that benefit from government privatization, contractors, SpaceX as the big example. So Elon Musk, the world's richest man, could be in a position to make recommendations about what government services to privatize, a privatization agenda that could ultimately send more contracts to the companies that Elon Musk owns.
David Sirota, thank you so much for being with us, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, host of the new investigative podcast, Master Plan. We'll link to your new piece, Election 2024, How Billionaire Avengers Destroy Democracy. Next up, we go to Amman, Jordan, to speak with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just left Gaza. UNICEF and other groups describe conditions there as apocalyptic. Stay with us. Speak of the World by Tamer Nafar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. As northern Gaza remains under a brutal Israeli siege for over a month, Al Jazeera reports at least 17 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes on the north since dawn. This follows Israeli attacks on at least two schools turned shelters for displaced people in Gaza City Thursday. Survivors said the bombing came without warning.
We were baking bread and our children were sitting around us and we were at the bottom and we saw nobody and the floor shook. The bomb hit and all the tents were destroyed. People ran. Some people were martyred on the floor. Rubble fell on us and people were torn to pieces. Where is the humanity? Where is the rest of the world? Where is the mercy? We have never seen any nation waging war on children. I am 65 years old and I've never seen any nation waging war on children.
Over 1,800 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the northern Gaza in October, many of them children, though that figure is likely a vast undercount, saying something like 70% of the population that has died are women and children. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks have also continued near central Gaza's Nusayr refugee camp and in Gaza City, where Israel's issued a new forced displacement order for Palestinians who have nowhere safe left to go. Top UN officials have again warned the entire Palestinian population in North Gaza, quote, is at imminent risk of dying from disease, famine, and violence, unquote. While UNICEF and other groups describe the conditions in northern Gaza as apocalyptic. For at least the past 7 weeks, Israel's persistently blocked life-saving humanitarian aid and food convoys from entering North Gaza, leaving families and children to starve. The last few operational hospitals in northern Gaza are on the brink of collapse, lacking critical supplies, while also coming under repeated Israeli attacks and raids, with many doctors and medical workers killed or detained. We go now to Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us from Amman, Jordan. He just left Gaza. Can you tell us what you saw with your own eyes, Jan?
Yeah, I spent 3 days in Gaza, and I'm shattered, really, as a human being by seeing so much suffering from Rafah in the south to Gaza City in the north. It's devastation beyond belief. This is a small territory where there are 2.2 million people crammed together with no escape, and under the most intense and most indiscriminate bombardment anywhere in the world in recent memory. And while they also starved, because very little aid is coming in, and the little aid which is coming in has enormous problems in being distributed. And in northern Gaza, just next door to Gaza City where I was, there is a besiegement which is a deliberate starvation of the population there while they're being bombarded to depopulate the area. This is unlawful also beyond belief. Every rule in the Geneva Conventions are being trampled on in Gaza.
Can you comment on what's called the General's Plan, drafted by Israeli military officers, calling for the systematic denial of humanitarian aid in the north, which has basically been labeled as ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, I mean, this, a lot of people fear this plan, have heard about this plan, and I don't know whether it is official Israeli policy, but what I know is that the effect of the Israeli military campaign is that people are driven out of northern Gaza systematically. And the settlers, these are the criminal gangs in the West Bank that are colonizing the land of the Palestinians, they are celebrating the Trump victory because they want to go back also and colonize Gaza, especially the north, where people are driven out. The Israeli defense forces have said that it is a deliberate campaign to drive people out with no return. And that is called, under the Geneva Convention, forcible transfer of people. And it's an atrocity crime. And there will be justice for this.
What about the significance of Israel formally notifying the United Nations it's canceling the agreement with UNRWA? What does that mean for aid organizations like your own, the Norwegian Refugee Council, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees?
Yeah, what's important to convey here is that when Israel, which itself is a product of a General Assembly resolution in 1948, Israel was created by the United Nations in the General Assembly resolution. Many Palestinians were driven out then of their ancestral land. The UN saw that, and therefore a second resolution came for the Palestinian, and that was UNRWA, 1950. It was created to provide relief and work and opportunities for the Palestinian refugees. So now the product of the first resolution is killing the product of the second resolution, and it would lead to even more suffering for the Palestinian population, both in the West Bank and in Gaza in particular. And my organization, which has courageous humanitarian worker on the ground, we provide water, shelter, education, relief, food for as many as we can. We're not able to take over what UNRWA is doing. They are the backbone of the relief to the Palestinian people. On the contrary, we would also be set back because they provide many of the logistic services, is their schools, is their fuel services, etc., that we, the non-governmental organizations, rely on.
So, Jan Eglin, let me ask you. Haaretz recently reported a senior Air Force official told Haaretz that without the American supply of weapons to the Israel Defense Forces, especially the Air Force, Israel would have had a hard time sustaining its war for more than a few months. Now, a leaked letter to Israel from Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Defense Secretary Austin, demanding Israel immediately allow U.S. humanitarian aid shipments to Gaza or face an interruption of arms shipments. They gave Israel until November 13th. Unclear why they have that grace period, but that's coming up. What would it mean if the U.S. stopped arming Israel?
I think it would be real leverage on this extreme policy, which is not self-defense. I mean, of course, Israel has a right of self-defense. all nations have that. And what they suffered on the 7th of October were terror and massacres beyond belief, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the others that were behind that has to be brought to justice. But what America has given indiscriminate arms to, and 2,000-pound bombs is no precision arm to go after terrorists. It is to level entire civilian neighborhoods. What the U.S. has fueled is an indiscriminate military campaign that is destroying the Gaza, which is filled to the brim with women and children that have no escape. So that is that the U.S. has not even been able to get Israel to provide the relief that we need to get in. Is beyond belief. It's been a diplomatic impotence that is astounding.
So you have President Biden that has given billions of dollars in aid, military weapons to Israel. Then you have incoming President Trump, whose son-in-law Jared Kushner talked about Gaza as valuable waterfront real estate. You are not only the head of a large refugee agency, but you are a seasoned diplomat. You were involved with one of the initiators of the peace talks that led to Oslo 93. What needs to happen now? Biden's still in office until January 20th. And then Trump takes over, expected to be even fierce as an even closer ally to Netanyahu.
Yeah, but he also wants to be close to the Gulf countries. And his son-in-law tried to negotiate this Abrams Accord, which was one between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and other Gulf countries. Which left out the Palestinians. But now the Gulf countries cannot accept any deal with Israel without some justice for the Palestinians. At that time, they could neglect the Palestinians. Not anymore. The public opinion in the Arab world would not accept it. So if Trump says America first, the present policy is Israel first, America second, and humanity third. Perhaps there could be some leverage now on Israel as the strongest party here, a ceasefire, end to the slaughter of civilians, a release for the hostages in exchange for a release of the arbitrarily detained Palestinians, and that could be the beginning of some peace process that could give justice and security to both sides. We cannot have wars every second year. It's not in Israel's interest to destroy its neighborhood in Gaza and in Lebanon. It will create new generations of hatred, and that is bad also for Israel.
Jan Egeland, your final comment right now, just after the U.S. election has taken place, the role that the U.S. plays when it comes to what Israel is doing, and what at this point, as endless UN and humanitarian organizations saying all of northern Gaza is on the verge of death, what Israel is trying to accomplish here?
What Israel has a cruel military logic, which is similar to that of President Assad of Syria, when he starved out besieged areas that were filled with civilians, but also with extremist militants inside. It's the same logic now for northern Gaza, where there's total besiegements of 100,000 people. I met some women who had come out with children, and they said, we were starving, we were being bombed, We left, and when we left, we were chased by Israeli tanks. I mean, this is the reality of this area, and the U.S. that has helped us in so many countries, from Sudan to the Sahel, to Colombia, to Myanmar.
Jan, we have 3 seconds.
Not been able to help us in Gaza.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just out of Gaza. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Diana Parra. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.